This is the Education Gadfly Show.
You're going to need a lot of technology.
That's right.
Has anyone thought about this yet?
I haven't heard too much discussion on that.
Okay. Minor detail.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello. This is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the Marco Rubio of Education Reform, Adam Emerson.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be back. But I think after last night, Marco Rubio is now the Marco Rubio of school reform.
That could be true, although unfortunately he's mostly known as a poster child for pulling strings water. Everybody seems to be talking about the big gulp. Boy, the poor guy, you know, you get thirsty.
I get thirsty during this program. I wish I had some water here.
Well, that's why you're the Marco Rubio. Exactly. Well, hey, everybody, we're going to mix it up a little bit in terms of our format today. We're very excited that we have John Kirtley, the chairman of Step Up for Students, a school choice organization in Florida, here with us. He's going to talk about our new study called School Choice Regulations, Red Tape or Red Herring. We had a great event about this study on Monday. John was supposed to participate, but alas, some fog in D.C. kept him from doing so. What this study finds is that private schools actually are not that worried about testing and accountability requirements of voucher and tax credit programs, that the places that do require private schools to take state tests and to report the results, that doesn't seem to be a major deterrent, at least not for most of the schools, compared to some of the other regulations that do deter them. So in this conversation, we're going to talk about those school choice regulations and whether they are a red tape or a red herring. So, John, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be with you, at least by computer, if not in person.
That's right. The magic of Skype. All right. Well, so John, as you know, what we found was that that regulations, though a concern for some schools that consider participating in these voucher or tax credit programs, there's some concern, but they weren't the foremost concern that schools had. Was that a surprise to you?
Not exactly, although I had a slightly different take than your report based upon my experience, certainly in Florida and in some other states as well. And your report, it had a very complicated formula, which I don't really understand in the appendix. But the gist of it was that if you are a Catholic school, then you are much less likely to be concerned about the regulations and testing and other aspects. But if you're a non-Catholic school, then you're likely to be more concerned about that. And I have a different experience in Florida. In my experience, and we have in Florida now about 1,500 schools, private schools that are signed up to take the kids under the tax credit program, and almost 1,300 actually do take them. Some are still waiting to take them, hoping to take them. So we have a pretty good data set, and what we have found is that the determining factor for whether a school is concerned about regulations or testing is how low income is the neighborhood that their school resides in. And the more they are in a low income neighborhood, the less they are going to be concerned about testing and regulations, regardless of whether it's a Catholic school or a non-Catholic school, or whether it's a religious school or a non-religious school. The income of the neighborhood, in my experience, is the determining factor. I have a hard time thinking of a private school in a low-income area in Florida that doesn't want to participate in the program, and their desire is so strong that they are very, very unconcerned about these aspects. Now, but as you go up the income scale in terms of the neighborhood, the schools tend to be more concerned about that. And this is true whether it's a non-sectarian school or a Catholic school. I mean, I can think of some very high-end Catholic schools in Florida that don't participate in the tax credit program. So again, the main takeaway I had was that the income of the neighborhood is the determinant rather than the type of school.
That's really, really interesting. We do have schools telling us that one of the major reasons they don't participate is that there's not many students eligible in their vicinity. But what do you think, John? I mean, are schools being honest here, or is it that these upper end schools simply don't want to take kids who are coming with all the challenges of poverty, that they're worried about whether they are going to be able to serve those students well and whether those kids are going to integrate well into the school.
Well, I'm sure that is a concern of many of those schools. We have several high-end schools in Florida. I wouldn't say many, but several of them that, as a matter of outreach and mission, will take these students. And to their credit, they take them at a significant loss mm-hmm. because by law, by statute, our scholarship right now is limited to about $4,500 per kid. And, you know, the tuition that some of these schools can, a high-end school in Florida can cost $18,000. And yet we still have some schools, and I can think of some in my own hometown of Tampa, that do reach out and take a few kids. And I give them tremendous credit for doing that. Now, we have other schools that don't take any at all, and I'm sure they have some of the concerns that you just articulated. But I think it's both a concern about cost and also a concern about culture that prevents these schools from reaching out.
Now, John, the program that you run, Step Up for Students, that you helped to found, is we found the most regulated of the tax credit programs, and particularly when it comes to testing and accountability. And there's some worry out there, particularly as we transition to Common Core standards and testing, that we're going to, in effect, be holding these private schools accountable to these new national standards, national tests. Is this something you worry about? What do you say to people who say, you know what, we should just let the free market decide and should avoid any focus on standards and accountability when it comes to this kind of testing?
Well, the first thing I wonder about, and I'll be very curious to see, is whether market forces dictate that the companies that now create the nationally recognized norm reference tests, whether market forces demand that those companies begin to test based on the Common Core. Mm. You know, right now in Florida, private schools that take tax credit kids must give either a nationally recognized norm reference test or the state test, the FCAT, and almost all of them give the former. As we transition to Common Core, will parents who send kids to private schools demand to know how their children are doing in relation to the Common Core? And if so, will companies that create like the Stanford 10 or the Iowa Basic Skills be forced to assess under that rubric? I'll be very curious to see. So if that happens, this whole issue goes away and there will be no controversy. But another aspect I'm very interested in is whether states that demand private schools taking scholarship kids be tested under Common Core, whether those states are willing to fund the technology upgrade it's going to take to do the assessment. In Florida, all the assessment under Common Core for public schools is going to be online.
Right.
And that's going to require a massive investment in the public schools. The state, if they just came out and said that private schools must immediately assess under Common Core standards, the private schools would have to invest millions in technology to comply. And again, many of our schools are schools in low-income areas that work miracles with very little money. They just don't have the funds to do that. Will the state be willing to, for example, perhaps increase the amount of the scholarship if they're willing to do the Common Core assessment? That'll be a very interesting policy debate.
That's a great question.
Well, and of course, beyond testing, too, there also raises a good point. In our study, what we did find was that private schools are concerned about some regulations more than others. And certainly one of the concerns that a lot of private schools had in considering whether to participate in these programs is whether they could maintain their own admission standards. Open enrollment is a big concern of a lot of private schools that we surveyed when they considered to enter these programs. What do you think, John? Should private schools be able to maintain their own admission standards when they do participate in these programs, however regulated they might be?
I do, and here's why I don't worry about that. When I read that concern in the report, again, I kind of had to laugh to myself because I was wondering how many schools in low-income areas were surveyed. And again, I think that the reaction to this question is really dictated to where the schools are located. The schools in Florida, the ones that are in low-income areas, which is the majority, Let me back up. One criticism that we often hear from opponents to parental choice programs is that they cream the best kids from the public schools. Well, we actually have data from the program in Florida that directly refutes that. And in fact, it's just the opposite. The report done by David Figlio showed that the Florida tax credit program is taking the poorest and the poorest performing children from the public schools. So if you were to survey, you know, all these schools in Florida that are taking these kids and ask them, you know, are you concerned about maintaining your selective admissions policies? They would laugh. They would say, look, we reach out and take all comers, and we take the hardest case kids, as is proven by this report. So I don't think it's a big concern for most of the schools that are serving the kids in these programs.
Fascinating. So that's the consistent message again and again, John, is when we think about the kinds of schools participating in these programs, it's not these high-end independent schools. It's not the Sidwell Friends, like where the president has his daughters. It's much more likely to be in sort of inner city, urban, Christian school or Catholic school, perhaps, you know, or in some cases, non-sectarian, just scraping to get by and serving low-income kids.
That is correct. Now, there, you mentioned Sidwell Friends. That's a great example of a school that did reach out under the Opportunity Scholarship Program in D.C. and serve kids on that program. And I give them tremendous credit for doing so. But until the voucher amounts or the tax credit scholarship amounts get large enough to create good supply in huge numbers, it's you're going to see that phenomenon. And that's one of my hopes, is that we will continue to see an increase in the per pupil scholarship amounts in these programs.
All right. Well, John Kirtley, again, with Step Up for Students. John, we appreciate your time and very much all of your work on behalf of low-income students in the great state of Florida. Thank you, John.
Pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much. Thank you.
All right, Adam, very interesting stuff, huh? And, you know, this question about Common Core assessments in private schools, mm-hmm. such as in Indiana and in Ohio and other places, Louisiana, mm-hmm. where they have to take the state test, really good question.
That's a good question, and it's probably going to change things in the course of the next few years. And you're starting to see a lot of Catholic school systems respond to this already.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I haven't heard anybody talk about this challenge of technology. I can't imagine the states are planning to pay for that technology in their schools. So that's
probably
something we need to dig into. All right. Well, now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So this interesting point here that John Kirtley just made about how private schools that are required to take state tests if they accept mm-hmm. scholarship kids, how are they going to do the Common Core test? They're going to need a lot of technology.
That's right. That's
Has anyone thought about this yet?
I haven't heard too much discussion on that.
Okay. Minor detail. Yikes. We're going to look into this one.
Yes, we are.
Uh-huh. After Common Core comes.
Yes. No. Got to do it now.
No.
All right. Well, Amber, this is a little bit of school choice day here at Fordham. I mean, not just because Adam's here, the author of our Choice Words blog, but That's because right. of what you're going to tell us about.
This week, we got a new study out by Pat Wolf and Mike Machine called Is the Juice Worth the Squeeze? How do you like that title?
Nice.
Wow. Like
they've
been
trying to turn some heads.
In our studies, haven't
title.
They?
A benefit cost analysis of the District of Columbia Opportunity Scholarship Program. Then they get serious. Mm. Also known as the DC Voucher Program, or OSP. Wolf, who also examined the academic impact of the DC voucher program, now looks at the cost and benefits of it. So essentially, he looks at his key finding from his prior evaluation that basically showed a 12 percentage point increase in graduation rates over the control group. And then he basically said, okay, let's take that finding and extrapolate it. So since 2004, the OSP has awarded vouchers to roughly 400 kids to attend 73 private schools. Wolf determines that the OSP had the potential to save the government roughly $134 million, given the difference in the cost of the program and the cost to educate an OSP student in DCPS. Okay. Yet, those savings were not realized because local officials agreed to hold DCPS financially harmless mm-hmm. when students left its system for the voucher program. Mm. So DCPS received about $15,000 per student in revenue, even when the kids left. Mm. So What they end up saying is the $70 million total price tag of the OSP represented a real additional cost to taxpayers, and this is the figure that they used in their estimates. So then he goes through this long explanation of using all these other prior studies that estimate the impact of various sort of societal returns, and he calculates the earnings of high school graduates, the money they pay in taxes, the health benefits of a diploma in terms of the quality of life, the cost associated with decreases in crimes, all these sort of societal studies we've seen before, and they estimate that a 12 percentage point increase in graduation rates above and beyond the control group equates to 421 additional graduates over the pilot phase of the program, which was 2004-2009, and then their key finding. The OSP produced $2.62 in benefits for every dollar spent on it. They provide upper and lower estimates that actually range from 36 cents to $7.82 in benefits for every dollar spent. And they conclude and say, you know, thankfully OSP was reauthorized as part of a budget compromise in 2011. And in a recent op-ed, they say that it's rare to have programs that perform better and save money, and this was one of them.
Now, did you just say that the range could really be between 36 cents and
$7.82?
I mean, if you were on the Price is Right and you had those kinds of ranges, you would
that's
not do
range.
So well, right?
Yes, that's upper and lower estimates.
Range.
Huge range.
Because we all are thinking about the State of the Union address this week, where President Obama was making claims like this for preschool programs, that they returned something, I think he said maybe like $10, perhaps, per dollar invested. I mean, these are all of these studies are make a lot of assumptions to go into this,
huge
right?
Huge assumptions, yeah. Yes. And in their defense, they go through and say, this is the research we're using, this is what they found, this is how we're estimating. So you have to buy into this long list of assumptions.
And one thing is you have to buy into the idea of a high school diploma as being a real standard. Now,
that's right.
In a program like this, I feel pretty comfortable that the schools these kids are in, you know, they have real standards there, that the kids have to pass in order to get their diplomas and all that sort of thing. I do worry about in some other initiatives that the definition of a high school diploma can get squishy, right?
Right.
I mean, schools can decide, well, we're going to give the kid all D's instead of all F's and get them across the finish line.
Well, and credit recovery, which we know can be problematic as well. You know, it was what these courses that they're recovering credit actually same in quality than the traditional brick and mortar course. Or are they better in some cases, which is what we're hearing.
Right. But at the same time, a high school diploma is a real world outcome. Unlike, say, just a test score, especially for younger kids. So this is interesting. This is exciting.
Yeah, and I think they ended up, and I hope I don't get this wrong, but they said, the value of a high school diploma is something like $360,000 over a course, of your lifetime in terms of not having a high school diploma. So there's still value in it, even though we tend to think, wow, high school diploma is not worth too much anymore.
Right.
You know, you got to have at least the college degree. But, there's still merit in it. So.
Yeah. Amber, do you have any reason to believe that this kind of research, which is quite compelling, is going to change the nature of the school choice debate? Where I'd be curious of what you think, Adam. I mean, do these kinds of studies make a difference, or is this just fundamentally an ideological debate?
Well, and this is just one more study that Pat Wolf has done that has really pointed out some real measurable outcomes, and especially in the DC program, but in other programs he studied too. I mean, the higher graduation rates that you find in DC, the OSP program, is similar to what he found in Milwaukee, similar to what we find in other programs, and yet we still time and time again read that voucher studies out there show mixed results, and I think we'll continue to see about that, no matter how rigorous Pat Wolf and his team will get, and they will continue to do that.
And that's right. I mean, that's
one of the more infuriating statements
true,
to read.
Right?
It's just not true.
That's just not true.
I mean, they're not sure.
This is a random assignment study that this came, And they use very conservative assumptions in this study and their prior studies. So
every single random assignment study ever done has shown either positive or null findings for vouchers.
And even if people want to debate the assumptions that they bring to the study, what is clear in his work and in the work of others, there's not one study out there that shows that there has been an adverse effect
on
these kids.
Right.
No harm has been done.
Right. I mean, I think the honest look at school choice is that the evidence for vouchers is stronger than the evidence for charter schools.
Exactly.
Now, I think if you narrow in on charter schools serving poor kids, in some respects, I think it's going to look largely the same. What happens in the charter school world is that we've got a lot of these charter schools serving middle-class kids who are purposely not trying to raise test scores, and that shows in the evidence. All right, till next week.
I'm Adam Emerson.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.